And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And America never looked greater in comparison to the other countries on earth than in Christmas season of 1916. In Europe, virtually every nation was suffering. The French troops on the line in France in the middle of World War I were about to mutiny. The Germans were desperate and hungry, suffering from the hunger blockade that the British had imposed. Russia, already crumbling, and on the verge of revolution. The Germans had largely won on the Eastern Front. But back in the United States, peace seemed to be at hand. Why? Well, we'll explain that and why President Wilson was so wrong about his expectations of peace. That part of the amazing story, World War I, the Great War or America's Greatest Mistake. At the end of 1916, President Wilson had just won re-election. He celebrated Christmas with his family, his daughters, and his new wife, Edith, in the White House. And he also caught the Christmas spirit by sending private notes to all of the leading belligerents, telling them that he wanted them to state their terms for peace. And he planned a new initiative for peace. He told his confidants that war had never been further from his mind. He was more confident than ever that peace would be at hand. And the newly reelected president, who hadn't even been inaugurated for his second term yet, told the Senate of the United States he wanted to make a very important speech on January 22nd, 1917, again, before he was even re-inaugurated, he went to the Senate and he spoke about how a lasting peace must be a peace without victory. Victory would mean peace forced upon the loser, he said, a victor's terms imposed upon the vanquished. It would be accepted in humiliation, under duress, at an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest. Not permanently, but only as upon quicksand. Only a peace between equals can last. His words now seem prophetic, and as a matter of fact, even at the time, his speech caused a sensation. He'd never gotten so much praise for any utterance he had ever given. Senator John Shafroth of Colorado called it, quote, the greatest message of a century. And the Atlanta Constitution wrote an editorial saying that the president's speech was startling, staggering, astounding, and the noblest utterance that has fallen from human lips since the Declaration of Independence. Confronted with that kind of praise, President Wilson said, "I have said what everybody else has been longing for, but has thought impossible. Now it appears to be possible." But the Allies were offended by his speech. They hadn't sacrificed everything for peace with victory. In fact, they had thought that Wilson would be more in their corner. His advisor, Colonel House, complained in his diary that Wilson now stood for peace at any price, that he had lost his punch. He subtly tried to bring that up with the president, and then Wilson said flatly, pounding the table, "There will be no war." He didn't know that the German high command and the Kaiser himself had already authorized, before he even spoke, the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare. And they had also done something else. And it is unclear how high up the chain of German command this decision went. But before the February 1st resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare, and remember that resumption of the unrestricted submarine warfare, they expected it would bring Americans into the war. And as to why that would be all right, Admiral von Holzendorf put it, the United States can scarcely engage in more hostile activities than she has already done up to this time. They assume that the biggest assistance the United States could ever give the Allies in the event of entering the war was monetary assistance, economic assistance, material assistance, and they were already getting that kind of assistance from America. They would disrupt that assistance with the submarine warfare. The German foreign minister at the time was a guy of a very, very limited competence named Arthur Zimmermann. And he proceeded to make one of the greatest diplomatic blunders imaginable. He sent a coded telegram to the Mexican government. And it was supposed to be carefully coded so no one would see it. And here's what the telegram said. It was very brief. It said, we intend to begin on the 1st of February unrestricted submarine warfare. We shall endeavor, in spite of this, to keep the United States of America neutral. In the event of this not succeeding, we make Mexico a proposal of alliance on the following basis. Make war together, make peace together. Generous financial support and an understanding on our part that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territory in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. Ouch! This was obviously inflammatory. It was also based on the fact that Wilson had sent American troops into Mexico twice before the World War I even began, and the Germans assumed the Mexicans would be very interested in this proposal. But before they could respond, the British, who were incredible at cryptography, they were in World War II, they were in World War I, the British had intercepted the telegram, and they broke the code, and they showed it to the Americans, and then they later released the telegram to the press. Can you imagine how folks in Texas may have felt about the German Kaiser through the German foreign minister, Arthur Zimmermann, offering Mexico to regain lost territory in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico if they made war against the United States? When this came about, when the announcement of unrestricted submarine warfare came about, when all of a sudden Wilson was again confronted, and now much more than ever, with actually firing on American ships. Up to this time, the Germans mostly had hit just merchantmen, British merchantmen. Now they hit American ships as well with their new fleet of U-boats, and it was devastatingly effective. With all of this going on, Wilson's secretary, Joe Tumulty, brought to him an Associated Press bulletin, which had the news of Germany's decision. And the president, according to his secretary, Joe Tumulty, turned gray and he said, "This means war. The break that we have tried to prevent now seems inevitable." But even after they began sinking American ships, even after the Zimmermann telegram and all of the controversy around it, Wilson hesitated. He did not feel that he could go to war. The new Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who was very pro-British and wanted Wilson to go to war, said the president is resisting the irresistible logic of events. At the end of March, House came to the White House, Colonel House, and he found Wilson repeating the same phrase again and again. What else can I do? Is there anything else I can do? He was losing sleep. And on April 1st, right before he went to Congress to deliver his war message, he invited a correspondent, Frank Cobb, of the New York World. He was one of the administration's strongest supporters, a favorite reporter, into the White House. And here's what he said. He told Cobb, "Once lead this people into war, and they'll forget there ever was such a thing as tolerance. To fight, you must be brutal and ruthless, and the spirit of ruthless brutality will enter into the very fiber of our national life, infecting Congress, the courts, the policeman on the beat, the man in the street." Cobb wrote, President Wilson thought the Constitution would not survive it, that free speech and the right of assembly would go. He said a nation couldn't put its strength into a war and keep its head level. It had never been done. If there is any alternative, for God's sake, let's take it, he exclaimed. But while he said those words, his finished war message was already on his desk, and he was prepared to go to Congress to ask for a declaration of war. That declaration and more coming up.
You're listening to a special show, World War I, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake.
The music of the great George M. Cohan, Grand Old Flag, very popular Broadway composer of the time. One of the songs no doubt played at the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson for his second term as president. He was inaugurated for his second term as president on March 5th, 1917. The Zimmerman telegram had already alarmed American opinion. The German declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare had already claimed additional American lives and additional American ships. The entire nation waited as the president delivered his inaugural address. And he said, with his truly remarkable gifts for rhetoric, "We are provincials no longer. The tragic events of the 30 months of vital turmoil through which we have just passed have made us citizens of the world. There can be no turning back. Our own fortunes as a nation are involved whether we would have it so or not. These, therefore, are the things we shall stand for, whether in war or in peace." And then he listed what he considered to be essential principles. He said that the essential principle of peace is the actual equality of nations in all matters of right or privilege, that peace cannot securely or justly rest upon an armed balance of power. And then, that national armaments shall be limited to the necessities of national order and domestic safety. National armaments shall be lifted? Are you kidding? In the midst of this brutal war, which America hadn't even formally entered yet. Wilson called the Senate into extraordinary session in less than a month after his inauguration. He addressed them on the 2nd of April, 1917. And as he came to Capitol Hill and the joint session of Congress waited for him silently, he said, "Gentlemen of the Congress, I have called the Congress into extraordinary session because there are serious, very serious choices of policy to be made, and made immediately, which it was neither right nor constitutionally permissible that I should assume the responsibility of making. The present German submarine warfare against commerce is a warfare against mankind," declared the President of the United States. "There is one choice we cannot make, we are incapable of making. We will not choose the path of submission and suffer the most sacred rights of our nation and of our people to be ignored or violated. The wrongs against which we now array ourselves are no common wrongs. They cut to the very roots of human life. With a profound sense of the solemn and even tragical character of the step I am taking, and of the grave responsibilities which it involves, but in unhesitating obedience to what I deem my constitutional duty, I advise that the Congress declare the recent course of the Imperial German government to be, in fact, nothing less than war against the government and the people of the United States." Congress listened silently. The president went on to document what he believed had been the profound German offenses. And then Wilson added these extraordinary passages. And reading them again, almost 100 years later, it still seems hard to believe that a president of the United States would say this on the verge of declaring war. "We are now about to accept gage of battle with this natural foe to liberty and shall, if necessary, spend the whole force of the nation to check and nullify its pretensions and its power. We are glad, now that we see the facts with no veil of false pretense about them, to fight thus for the ultimate peace of the world and for the liberation of its peoples, the German peoples included, for the rights of nations great and small and the privilege of men everywhere to choose their way of life and of obedience. The world must be made safe for democracy. Its peace must be planted upon the tested foundations of political liberty. We have no selfish ends to serve. We desire no conquest, no dominion. We seek no indemnities for ourselves, no material compensation for the sacrifices we shall freely make. We are but one of the champions of the rights of mankind. We shall be satisfied when those rights have been made as secure as the faith and the freedom of nations can make them. Just because we fight without rancor and without selfish object, seeking nothing for ourselves, but we shall wish to share with all free peoples, we shall, I feel confident, conduct our operations as belligerents without passion, and ourselves observe with proud punctilio the principles of right and of fair play we profess to be fighting for." He repeatedly said America was not going into war for self-interest. On what other basis do you lead a nation to war if not self-interest? It's extraordinary. That same Wilsonian strain in foreign policy is unfortunately still alive. Wilson concluded with almost unparalleled eloquence. And the Congress was enraptured and captivated, as ultimately the whole country was. He said, "It is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful people into war, into the most terrible and disastrous of all wars, civilization itself seeming to be in the balance. But the right is more precious than peace, and we shall fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right, by such a concert of free peoples as shall bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. To such a task we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes, everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other." The Congress rose and applauded and cheered. They debated the declaration of war. There were 50 members of the House who voted against the declaration of war. 50. Six U.S. senators, including some of the most prominent progressives, voted against the declaration of war. But we're turning from the Capitol building, riding in the presidential car. Wilson loved cars. And with the applause of Congress and America at large still echoing in his ears, he was sitting next to his secretary, Joe Tumulty, and he said, "My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems to applaud that." More in a moment. One week after President Wilson asked for the declaration of war, in April 2nd, 1917, he had a visitor at the White House. The visitor was Theodore Roosevelt, the former president, his old rival, someone who had attacked Wilson repeatedly, attacked Wilson for being delaying and insufficiently resolute and for misleading the country. They had run against each other for president in 1912. And T.R., the old bull moose, who was 58 years old, came to Wilson and asked for permission to lead a division of volunteers into battle. Since there was a war, he wanted to be part of it. He had led, obviously, his division of his regiment of volunteers, the Rough Riders, to glory in the Spanish-American War. That was 19 years before. Wilson said no to Roosevelt. But all four of Roosevelt's sons enlisted, and they all saw combat. Theodore Jr. and Archie were both wounded in action. Theodore was gassed during the war. The youngest son, 20-year-old Quentin, became a pilot, and he was killed when his plane was shot down a few months before armistice. It shattered Roosevelt's life. Another White House visitor, William Jennings Bryan, also in his late 50s, also volunteered to serve in combat, despite the fact that he had been so much opposed to going to war initially. Wilson also thought Bryan should stay home and help the cause of propaganda, because propaganda was crucial. The war was not initially overwhelmingly popular. Remember, 50 members of the House and 6 senators had voted against it. One of America's most influential politicians, the leader of the Socialist Party, a guy who had gotten 1 million votes in a country that was much smaller, only 90 million Americans at that time, Eugene Victor Debs, went to jail for opposing the war. Wilson helped to organize a new agency called the Committee on Public Information. He recruited a gentleman named George Creel, who was a Denver newspaper man, to run it. And they recruited 75,000 4-Minutemen, whose jobs was to go around to churches. They went to movie theaters. They spoke in intermissions at movie theaters. They spoke at shopping centers. And they were supposed to give 4-minute little speeches talking about how wonderful and appropriate the war was and to build up public enthusiasm. Also were urged to urged others to inform on any man who spreads pessimistic stories, cries for peace, or belittles our efforts to win the war. That was the mood of the country, just as Wilson foresaw before he asked for the declaration of war. But for the mood of the country, nothing more important than music, than Over There, the song written by the great George Cohan. The words came to him, the music came to him almost miraculously, as he was riding between New Rochelle and New York on a train shortly after the declaration of war.
Over there, send the word over there, that the boys are coming, the boys are coming, the drums rum-tumming everywhere, so prepare, say a prayer. It's over, over there.
But before they could get over there, that sung and performed by Michael Feinstein, by the way, before they could get to France, it took a long time, months and months of recruitment and training, and they barely made it in time to save the Allied cause. Because while the British and the French were waiting for the Americans to arrive over there, there were literally 1 million French men who were mutinying, deserting their ranks. The Germans had launched a new offensive, and this war to which America committed itself did not look like it was over there. Not yet. And what about the peace? That too and more we'll get to in moments. Not everyone volunteered to join the new war like Theodore Roosevelt did and like William Jennings Bryan did. In fact, there were only 73,000 volunteers, far less than expected in the first 6 weeks after the declaration of war. So Congress had to institute a draft. And there was resistance to the draft. And there was strong opposition to the war. A lot of that opposition, of course, was confined to the German-American community. We were taken up with war hysteria. People banned the teaching of German in our schools. Sauerkraut was retitled Liberty Cabbage. Frankfurters were no longer called Frankfurters. They were called Liberty Sausage. There was a great attempt to basically demonize the Germans and to demonize anyone who wanted to affirm German identity. And the two largest immigrant groups in the country both tended to be anti-war. Irish Americans, the second largest immigrant group in the United States at a time when America was 30% foreign-born, Irish Americans were also opposed to the British and the French and often opposed to America going to war because during the war in 1916, there had been the uprising in Ireland, the Dublin Rising, and the Germans had promised to help the Irish win their independence, and the British had been very ruthless in suppressing drives for Irish independence. With all of that going on, there was, of course, enough enthusiasm to send 2 million Americans overseas, but they only got there some full year after the declaration of war. It took that long to recruit, to train, to equip, and to transport Americans in 1917. But after Americans arrived and became fully engaged in the fighting in May of 1918, they turned the tide of battle and turned it very decisively. Americans experienced horrendous casualties, so did everyone else who participated in that particular war. And aside from the influx of men and materiel and support that turned the tide of battle, another contribution of the war was Wilson and his rhetoric and his gift for propaganda. He issued his famous 14 points, and he did it without the approval of his allies. In January 1918, he laid out what he considered to be the basis for a peace. The 14 points included 1, open treaties openly arrived at. 2, absolute freedom of navigation on the seas and peace and war. 3, removal of all economic barriers and establishment of equal trade conditions among all parties to the peace. 4, multilateral arms reductions, in other words, disarmament. 5, adjustment of colonial claims based on the interests of the populations concerned. And his final of the 14 points was, quote, a general association of nations to guarantee political independence and territorial integrity for all members. He had been dreaming of a League of Nations, and he believed that going to the old idea of a peace without final victory, that could be achieved. Part of what happened is the exhausted Germans heard Wilson, took him seriously, and in October of 1918, after staggering casualties, after enormous sacrifices, with starvation and hardship at home, the German government sued for peace, not to the British, who they'd been fighting for 4 years, not to the French, but to President Wilson. Wilson negotiated directly an armistice with the Germans that took hold on November 11th, 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And the world celebrated, and a peace conference was called. How was the peace lost? Because it was lost, because, of course, as the world knows, 21 years later, we were at war again. President Wilson made 2 crucial mistakes about the Versailles conference. 1, he went there personally. All historians agree with his advisors. It was American tradition. A president was not supposed to be away from the White House, away from American territory, for months on end. President Wilson was. But aside from that, by being at the peace conference personally, he was reduced in status. He could have been the disinterested leader of the whole world if he had communicated by telegraph and telephone with people in Europe, and he had remained at home, but he went personally. The other problem, he did not have opposition representation with him at the peace conference. One of the things that demonstrates how unpopular the war was in the middle of waging this war, and right after the war was all but won, just days before the armistice, there was a congressional election, and Wilson lost both houses of Congress. The Republicans took over both houses of Congress, in a sense, because people may not have shared his soaring visionary expectations for making peace. And the Republicans seemed more hard-headed and practical. When he came back with the Versailles Treaty, there were two problems with it. One problem was that all of the promises of the 14 points about open covenants openly arrived at, about no imposition and no punitive peace, and he had promised it again and again and again, they made a punitive peace. Germany was subjected to, number one, a war guilt clause in the treaty that said that they were responsible for the entire war. They didn't feel that they were. They felt they had waged basically a defensive war. They were also required to pay onerous reparations, which crippled their economy for years and helped to lead to Hitler. Aside from that, Germany was dismantled. It lost 1/8 of its territory and 1/10 of its population that was assigned to other nations, and also provided the basis for Hitler later. But Wilson got his League of Nations. The problem with the League of Nations is the covenant of the League, and notice covenant, the religious language, the covenant of the League of Nations included a clause that would have obligated the United States to go to war without a declaration of war by Congress. It would have taken U.S. sovereignty and given it to the League of Nations. The Republicans were deeply opposed. They wanted to ratify the treaty and the League, but only with reservations. The results? Tragic. Could it have been otherwise? We'll get to that and more coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MedvedHistoryStore.com.
Wilson came home from Versailles in 1919 to a nation already deeply disillusioned with his war to end all war. The Republicans, who dominated both houses of Congress and who dominated the U.S. Senate that had to approve the Treaty of Versailles, were not unalterably opposed to it. They were not isolationists. They, in fact, were internationalists who wanted America to lead the world. But they did not want to compromise on several of the points involving American sovereignty. Wilson did also refuse any compromise at all. Historians say that if he had accepted the reservations that had been proposed by Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, the treaty would have won nearly unanimous support in the Senate of the United States, and we would have gone into the League. But Wilson refused. Instead, he launched a campaign to win public support for the treaty. He got sick in the middle of the campaign, traveling around the country by train, giving speeches to adoring crowds. He suffered his first stroke in Paris when he was still negotiating at Versailles, then another minor stroke on the train, and then a much more serious stroke back at the White House in Washington. He was incapacitated. He should not have continued as president. He had lost the power to concentrate more than 5 or 10 minutes at a time. His speech was slurred. He lay in a White House bed with darkened shutters, unavailable to the world. And so ended his presidency. Could it have been different? Could the entire disaster of World War I, and yes, it was a disaster, none of our war aims were achieved, could it have been different if we had stayed out? Pat Buchanan has written an interesting book on this subject. It's called A Republic, Not an Empire, Reclaiming America's Destiny. I don't agree with everything in the book, but he gives a good summary of the arguments against American involvement. He writes, "No one can say for certain how history would have unfolded had America stayed out of the Great War. Without the U.S. government becoming the lender of last resort to finance the war effort, with no prospect of millions of American troops pouring into the trenches, the Allies would probably have been forced to negotiate an armistice or sue for peace. The Kaiser's army, bloodied but undefeated, would have gone home. Germany would have become a firewall against any drive into Central Europe by Soviet Russia. A strong, united, and prosperous Germany would not have spawned a Hitler. There might have been no Holocaust, no quarter-century reign of Stalin, no Cold War. Had America stayed out, there would have been no Versailles, no occupation and dismemberment of the German nation, no American war dead, no debt, no era of disillusionment. Had America not financed the war, it surely would have ended earlier than it did, with far fewer dead. Hard to argue with that proposition, and hard to look at the war with so much American heroism on the battlefield, with such heroic rhetoric from Woodrow Wilson, without seeing it not as a pathetic failure, but as tragedy of the very highest order. But a tragedy and a mistake with which Americans must come to terms to understand the recent history of this greatest nation on God's green earth.